Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. 50 years ago this week, Senator Joseph McCarthy stepped to the rostrum at a meeting of the Women's Republican Club in Wheeling, West Virginia, and announced that he had a list of 205 subversives employed by the U.S. State Department. He was not the first to make such a claim, neither was he the first to engage in anti-communist activity in the United States. But his speech fanned the already existing flames of fear into a conflagration that swept the nation for several years to come. In a moment, Talking History's Dennis Mihalik will talk with historian Ellen Schrecker about that episode in American history. But first, let's take a look at an important event from this week in history. It was during this week in 1948 that General Dwight D. Eisenhower resigned as U.S. Army Chief of Staff. Eisenhower, raised in Abilene, Kansas, graduated from the U.S. Military Academy, West Point, in 1915. He served in World War I and then continued his studies at the Command and General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and the Army War College in Washington, D.C. In 1933, he was named Special Assistant to General Douglas MacArthur, under whom he served as military advisor to the Philippines. In 1939, Eisenhower was named head of the War Plans Division of the Office of Army Chief of Staff and subsequently Chief of its Operations Division. In June 1942, he was appointed commander of the U.S. forces in the European theater of World War II, and 2 years later, supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force in Western Europe. In November 1945, Eisenhower succeeded Marshall as Army Chief of Staff, from which he resigned 52 years ago this week. He became president of Columbia University and, of course, in 1952, was elected president of the United States. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Don't Tell the Bolsheviks, but a portrait of executed Russian Tsar Nicholas II was recently reported to have been leaking myrrh, forcing Russian Orthodox Church officials to consider whether or not the country's last imperial leader should be canonized. In the Orthodox tradition, the mere presence of myrrh, a gum resin, on relics or portraits can be considered a miracle. Ever since the Tsar and his family were executed as a result of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1918, the ruler's portrait has been hanging in the Orthodox Church of Moscow. A recent archaeological finding near the Columbia River in Washington may have revealed the oldest complete human skeletal remains in North America. The skeleton, identified by researchers as Kennewick Man, was found in 1998, and after some consideration of what some thought were his Caucasian features, nevertheless connected to the Native American hunter-gatherers that roamed the continental United States for centuries before Columbus. Found with a sharpened stone arrow buried in his hip bone, the discovery of Kennewick Man stirs the recurring debate between the federal government and American Indians over what property rightfully belongs to whom. If officials can determine a distinct connection between Kennewick Man and Native American tribes living in the region, his bones may be returned to local Indian leaders for proper burial. Otherwise, in all likelihood, the skeletal find will remain under the jurisdiction of scientists for further study. You're listening to Talking History. Joseph McCarthy's name has become so closely linked to the period of rabid anti-communism in the 1950s that the very activity of searching for and exposing communists in the United States at that time was called McCarthyism. Ellen Schrecker has written a book on McCarthyism, and here to talk with her about that book is Talking History's Dennis Mihalik.
Thank you, Brian. 50 years ago, on February 9, 1950, Senator Joseph McCarthy gave a speech to the Women's Republican Club in Wheeling, West Virginia, in which he claimed that he had a list of 205 subversives employed by the United States State Department. Because of that speech and his subsequent actions, the 1950s anti-communist crusade in the United States has been dubbed McCarthyism. Here to put that episode in historical perspective is Ellen Schrecker, professor of history at Yeshiva University, the author of numerous books and articles on anti-communism, the most recent being Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, published by Little Brown and Company. Welcome, Professor Schrecker.
Thank you.
Exactly who was Joe McCarthy?
Joe McCarthy was an ambitious junior senator from Wisconsin who had not distinguished himself in any way until he showed up waving those lists of supposed communists in the State Department. And he became notorious for a cause that many other politicians had embraced earlier, that of attacking the Truman administration for being, quote-unquote, soft on communism. He was a Republican. It was a cause that Republicans particularly embraced. And McCarthy gained notoriety, not so much because of what he was saying, but because of the sort of indiscriminate, unfounded charges that he was making. It was very clear there were no 205 communists in the State Department. In fact, McCarthy kept changing the numbers of names that he was attacking. He talked about, I think it was 57, then a smaller number, and kept fluctuating. Often when pressed for evidence, he would become evasive and bring out some new names. So that it turns out he was really more of a gadfly and a pest than he was somebody who was actually carrying out a real crusade.
Mm-hmm. Well, were communists actually discovered in the employ of the United States government?
By the time McCarthy made his charges, there were very few, if any, communists in the government. What we have to do is put all of this in perspective and realize that during the 1930s, during the Depression, communism appealed to more people than it ever would again. And that some of these people to whom it appealed did get government jobs. We now know, in fact, that some of these people even spied for the Soviet Union. But we also have to realize that during World War II, the Soviet Union and the United States were allies. And after the war ended, the federal government began to ease communists out of the government. Truman, in 1947, implemented what came to be known as the Loyalty Security Program, which got really tried to eliminate most people who had some kind of association with communism from the federal government, and it was extremely successful. So that by the time McCarthy comes around, 3 years later, there really are a few, if any, communists in any sensitive positions in the government.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, why did so many people listen to his message? I mean, McCarthyism is usually described, quote, as a hysteria, unquote.
I think that that usual description is probably incorrect. One of the things that I looked for when I was working on Many Are the Crimes is some evidence of a kind of popular hysteria, as you call it, of a popular groundswell. And yes, people were anti-communist, but the anti-communist crusade that McCarthy latched onto came not from the grassroots, but from within the political establishment. It was an extremely useful tool, an extremely useful weapon for the Republican Party to attack the Democrats with. And in fact, the real roots of McCarthyism, I think, are within ordinary partisan politics and were very useful for the Democrats because in the late 1940s, the Democratic administration had co-opted the Republicans into the Cold War, and it was Truman and his the rest of the American policymakers were maintaining a bipartisan foreign policy so that the Republicans really couldn't attack the Democratic administration with regard to communism overseas because they had signed on to what the administration was doing. So that they focused instead on quote-unquote communism in government, which was the issue that McCarthyism several years later began to sort of play up even more. But it was already in existence as early as the late 1930s, which is interesting. The issue of communism in government actually predates the Cold War.
Yes. And then it also goes beyond this attacking Democrats. That is, I'm thinking, why did McCarthy continue his personal crusade after Eisenhower became president in 1953?
I think there you have to look for the reason in aberrant psychology, as it were. McCarthy clearly was a very gifted demagogue, but he was also something of a loose cannon. And once he began this kind of crusade, it really took him over. And he, most of his biographers believe that by the end of his life, he was a true believer and really felt there was some kind of a communist conspiracy within the government. So that he kept on attacking the Republican administration even after, you know, it was no longer a useful tool for the Republican Party. What's interesting is that McCarthy was sort of picked up by a small group of politicians and columnists and private individuals, businessmen, who I call the anti-communist network. And these are people who are professionally devoting their lives to the anti-communist cause. Most of them are very conservative. Some of them are anti-communists who switched and sort of adopted the cause as their justification for what they were doing. Some of them are columnists. There are labor union leaders. There are clergymen and priests. And these are people who really defined a lot of what McCarthyism was. They selected the targets, and McCarthy himself relied very heavily on this particular group of anti-communists to supply him with his quote-unquote lists, for example. So that by the end of his life, he's really become a kind of fringe character who is working with this anti-communist network.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, did McCarthyism and this network result in numerous people being convicted of a crime and sent to jail?
It depends on how many, what you would call numerous. I figured there were probably about 200 people who may have gone to prison for one or another quote-unquote crime during the McCarthy period. Most of those crimes are what have been called offense artifacts. In other words, they're not real crimes in the sense that, say, burglary or murder or rape are crimes. They're not even crimes like espionage is a crime. They're crimes that were sort of developed to incriminate communists, like contempt of Congress, like perjury. In other words, individuals who are considered guilty of the quote-unquote political crime of being communist or being associated with communism are then often forced into a position where they will be breaking the law in a technical way, even though it's something that under other conditions would not be a crime. So that, yes, the criminal justice system was being used to prosecute people and to criminalize people for their politics. Now, it is true that there had been espionage, especially during World War II. Not many of the people who were involved with that espionage were actually ever convicted. we now know that one of the reasons was that the evidence that was used to find them were these intercepted telegrams, the so-called Venona telegrams, which had been sent by the KGB in the United States to headquarters in Moscow and had been intercepted by the FBI and later, after World War II, decrypted. And these telegrams did give information about the kind of espionage activities that were going on. But the federal government never wanted to reveal the existence of those telegrams, and in fact they weren't revealed until 1995, mm-hmm. long after the Cold War. So,
well, along those lines, yeah. then, now that the Soviet Union has fallen apart and many of its government records are now becoming public, do you think those records will clarify things like the Rosenbergs and atomic secrets and so forth?
Those records are clarifying things, but one has to take them with a grain of salt because the Russians are not opening them to all scholars. Sometimes you have to pay for them, and it's very hard for a scholar sometimes to see records that other people have looked at. So we, it's kind of like a black box, and you dig in and you pull something out, but you don't know what else is in there. So as of now, we do have answers for some people. You know, the archives have corroborated enough material so that, you know, if one person is mentioned in three separate different types of documents, you can be pretty you can make a fairly reasonable assessment that that person has been involved in something. But in other cases, we still don't have any records at all. Particularly the case which is probably the most notorious, that of Alger Hiss. It seems likely that he was involved in spying for the Russian military intelligence, not the KGB. And those records have not been opened. So although it's quite likely that he was involved, we don't have the kind of evidence that we do for, say, the Rosenbergs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in your books, including the last one, Many Are the Crimes, you state that a McCarthyism, 50 years after the fact, remains very sensitive in American society. Why is that?
It's one of those questions that's real hard to answer. You know, I interviewed a lot of people who had been affected by McCarthyism, and some of them simply refused to talk. They had been really badly burned, and they somehow felt that even now, 50 years after the time, it was still too sensitive. I'm not really sure why. I think this is one of these questions that I ask myself. I wake up in the middle of the night and say, why? Why can't we get this behind us? I think in part it may have to do with a kind of post-Cold War triumphalism. In other words, the assumption is the Cold War is over, quote-unquote, we won, and therefore it's necessary to justify what happened. It's therefore necessary, in a sense, to claim that the victory, whatever victory it was justified, and that therefore McCarthy in some bizarre way was right. I personally am not so sure that one has to look at these things in terms of black and white. I'm not sure that there were any victors. I'm not sure that the finding that espionage occurred during World War II necessarily justifies everything, all the repression that was visited upon communists, ex-communists, people who hung out with communists during the late 1940s and 50s. For example, my own sixth grade teacher lost his job in the middle of the Red Scare, mm-hmm. mainly because once upon a time he had been a member of the Communist Party. He was no longer at that time, And there's no justification for firing a sixth grade teacher for once having been a communist. And so I think that we have to sort of go back and reassess this in terms of proportionality, in terms of a sort of sense of getting really what was the threat of trying to understand this quote-unquote communist menace.
Mm-hmm. Well, that will have to be for another day. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I'd like to thank our guest, Ellen Schrecker, author of Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, published by Little, Brown & Company.
As we just heard, the hunt for communists dominated American thinking in the 1950s, but it did not exist alone. It was matched by another concerted effort to restore American patriotism and civic activism. Here to explain how the two were linked is historian Richard Fried, professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Professor Fried is the author of Nightmare in Red, McCarthyism in Perspective, and, most recently, The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, Pageantry and Patriotism in Cold War America.
While America's dread of communism was growing, another broader trend emerged alongside it, a vast effort to promote patriotism and civic activism. Leaders, both national and local, feared that Americans had become too selfish, apathetic, and privatist for the nation's good in the long Cold War struggle. Many business and government elites looked nostalgically to the now vanished commitment and solidarity Americans had shared in the late war, and they deplored the post-war letdown. President Truman, his Attorney General Tom Clark, other politicians, educators, and moguls of Madison Avenue decried a rise in crime and juvenile delinquency, a reluctance to vote or perform jury service, and signs of individual and group selfishness. These rather conservative values were not just found on the right of the political spectrum. Some Cassandras prescribed remedies for civic laxity. Tom Clark persuaded a blue ribbon group of national leaders to sponsor the Freedom Train in 1947. This train carried historic documents to 325 cities, each of which held exercises aimed at making people more aware of their civic duties. The calendar was patriotized, too. The veterans of foreign wars countered the left's May Day demonstrations with Loyalty Day, whose parades were an annual Cold War observance from 1948 on. In 1949, Congress voted to proclaim Flag Day every year. Armed Forces Day debuted in 1950. Patrioteers also strove to remind Americans frequently of the nation's call on their allegiance. In the 50s, service clubs and other groups worked to make sure every school had a flag or a recording of the national anthem, and that the anthem was sung and the flag saluted at athletic events. In 1955, yielding to the American Legion, the National Football League even changed the prescribed referee signal for unnecessary roughness. Legionnaires teaching flag protocol in the schools had run into a snag. When they snapped off a flag salute, some youngsters confused it with roughing the passer. While some of these efforts bore fruit, their sponsors sensed a battle unending against lax citizenship and patriotism, lectured that they must defend their birthright, which was frequently defined as prosperity and freedom to select among life's bountiful options. Americans often elected those options rather than attend patriotic and civic exercises. Ironically, what we were defending made defense more difficult. Prosperity partly undermined the American way, as it may also have dulled the fervor on which McCarthy depended. While capitalism's cornucopia has been credited with subverting Soviet communism, behind the gates of the free world, it was at least mildly subversive as well.
You've been listening to Richard Fried, professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. This is Talking History. Welcome back. For our site of the week, we extend our discussion of anti-communism in America to consider the larger subject of the Cold War. In particular, we call to your attention a most unusual museum on the Cold War, a museum that actually could be coming to your town sometime soon. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
This Cold War Museum is a traveling exhibit. It was founded in 1996 and displays historical artifacts associated with the U-2 incident of May 1960. The exhibit has made several appearances around the country and is currently in Berlin, Germany until July 1st of this year. It is expected to then arrive at the Newseum in Arlington, Virginia. After that, it will move on to the Museum of Flight in Seattle from September to March of 2001. If you can't catch the traveling Cold War Museum, but you want to know more about communism, you can search the George Mason University website for the Museum of Communism, which provides historical, economic, and philosophical analysis of the political movement.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. PBS has two shows coming up that look interesting. On February 21st, the biography, The Richest Man in the World, Andrew Carnegie, will air as part of PBS's American Experience series. On February 22nd, a new show will premiere on the Roman Baths, a vital site of leisure and social activity in the ancient world. Roman Baths is included in PBS's Secrets of Lost Empire series and is a Nova special presentation. Giving you a chance to use that remote, we invite you to tune in the History Channel each evening from February 22nd through February 25th for a series on Civil War combat. The series will feature examinations of the battles fought at Gettysburg on February 22nd, Antietam on February 23rd, Shiloh on the 24th, and Cold Harbor on February 25th. Be sure to consult your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week for our show on Runaway Slaves. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5, KIOS.